Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Carl Zeigmund, Professor Emeritus of Mathematics at the University of Vienna, and we're talking about his book, The Waltz of Reason, The Entanglement of Mathematics and Philosophy. Carl, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to finally be able to talk to you.
Thank you. The pleasure is all mine.
Now, what led you to write a book about the interconnected lives of mathematics and philosophy? A lot of people would say there's no connection whatsoever, but you write in your book, they've dated for ages.
Yes, indeed. There have been 2,500 years, I should say, that mathematicians and philosophers have been very interested in each other. And both were actually, both philosophy and mathematics was born at about the same time in ancient Greece. And often it was the same thinker who was both a philosopher and a mathematician. For instance, Leibniz or Bertrand Russell and so on.
But
and I think the connection is, yes, sorry, I didn't want to interrupt.
No, that's
you.
Okay. No, I don't want to interrupt you. Is that still true today, though?
Yes, most certainly. I think that many, many philosophers find that mathematics is a particularly interesting field to study because mathematics is not empirical. It is not based on experience, yet it is true. So how come? This is a very odd object for philosophers. And vice versa, I think that mathematics has tools to offer to philosophy. Tools for thinking about chance or about social contract or about the common will or whatever to make the concepts more precise. So mathematics is both an object of wonder and a tool, I believe, for philosophers.
Would you therefore recommend mathematicians to read more philosophy and vice versa?
Oh, definitely, yes. I think it is... It doesn't need, by the way, much recommendation. I know a lot of my colleagues who are quite well-versed in philosophy. And, with the philosophers, there is a distinction. Some are extremely interested in mathematics. For them, it is topic number one, so to speak. Huh. Wittgenstein is an example. And others are left absolutely cold, like Heidegger or Sartre. Yes.
Yeah, I can't imagine Sartre reading mathematics.
Indeed, yes.
did he ever mention it? Did he ever write about mathematics? I don't remember reading anything by Sartre about mathematics.
No, I don't think so, yes.
So what happened? What happened to philosophy and mathematics that there seemed to be a schism between them? I mean, you mentioned people like Wittgenstein and other philosopher mathematicians. But today it seems like there's a schism between the two fields.
Well, a schism, there was always a schism, I believe, despite the mutual interest. Mathematics was solving problems, and when they had a theorem, it held forever. It was true, it was proven. In philosophy, there is no such thing. There philosophers are wrestling with puzzles which simply can't be stopped. They come up again and again and can be seen from this side and from that side.
So yeah, yeah.
Techniques, their approach is utterly different, and I don't think it can ever be merged, despite the fact that there have been, as I mentioned, some people able to do both at a very high level.
Carl, who do you envision as being the ideal reader for this book? And we have to talk about how much mathematics or logic does the reader need before picking up this book?
Well, I don't think that the reader needs to know more of mathematics or logic than a normal 15, 16-year-old person has picked up. I'm certainly not writing for an expert audience. I try to capture people fresh, so to speak, and get them interested. So I had, of course, young persons in mind. of the sort of my undergraduates, but this is not certainly not tied to any age.
I was surprised about how much fun this book was.
Thank you. I try to keep it light and
well, you're also a jokester. There's a lot of puns and jokes throughout this book.
I tried my best. Yes, believe me.
Now, you write that many mathematicians are Platonists, and even more are hedonists. I can believe the former, but it's hard to believe that mathematicians are hedonists. Convince me.
Well,
are you a hedonist?
I say this from, yes, definitely.
You are.
I do mathematics for pleasure, and I've always done it for pleasure, and already when I was 16 years old. And I think that most students, actually, they know, of course, when they start mathematics course, that this will be useful in life, and they can do physics with it or go into insurance companies or whatever. But I think that most are attracted by the beauty, the pleasure of mathematics.
Yeah.
This can come in very different ways. It can be simply solving a little riddle, or there is this recreational mathematics. There are these pleasures of solving a Sudoku or a problem of patience is also a mathematical problem, essentially, yes? So you can do it in a small scale, like it's similar to songs, say, or to have a vast edifice and study that, a mathematical theory. This is like a symphony by Beethoven or so. So it can come at every level. But I would certainly compare it with the pleasure given by music.
I love the fact that you wrote about that pleasure in this book. And it was really important for me to read your words about it, that mathematics and insight, there's a charge you get when you solve a problem like that. Unless you do it, maybe for music, but maybe a really complicated crossword puzzle or some other kind of puzzle, the idea that you finally solve it, it has a physical response in our body.
That's right. And many people speak of, they are seeing a light, there is some enlightenment, there is this aha effect. But sometimes they are wrong, and after a minute later, they see that, oops, they made a mistake after all. But nevertheless, it is an emotional response to mathematical problems.
Well, that's what you talk about as the flash of understanding. There really is that sense like, aha, the big aha moment. But as you just talked about, there's a chasm of possibilities between aha and oops.
Yes,
but sometimes, but generally, doesn't the oops lead you to the aha later on?
Well, if you persist, this is of course a very important thing. One needs in mathematics to have patience. It is. I will not hide it. A hard science, and you have to sit down and really think hard and get ready to have many frustrations, certainly. But the pleasure outweighs this in the long run, I'm sure.
But you have to train yourself as a mathematician to deal with failure.
Yes, I think
because
so.
It seems like you couldn't succeed as a mathematician unless you deeply understood failure and were able to move beyond it.
Yes, to try another problem for a while.
Yeah.
But the first problem keeps you nagging, of course, maybe in the subconscious. And then after some time, return maybe or so. And sometimes one has success and sometimes not. Yes, there were also great mathematicians who went from success to success. And I myself cannot claim the same thing. There are many problems which have nagged me and which I haven't solved. But yes, that's it. But some other problems will come and one can have a more positive experience with them.
In this book, which I love this book, The Waltz of Reason. First of all, I even love the fact that you put waltz in the title, and we're talking to Vienna. That was perfect.
Yes.
Good on you.
And the subtitle is The Entanglements of Mathematics and Philosophy. And entanglement with Schrödinger and Zeilinger, two Nobel Prize winners.
Quantum theory.
Is also something Vienna is. Yes.
Yeah, quantum theory. It's fantastic. This book is also not just about the ideas. It's about the people who came up with these ideas, these proofs and theorems. And that's another thing I really loved about this book is that I got to learn more about these people. Now, some of them I obviously knew and knew them really well. But others I'd never read about before. And I want to talk about two in particular. Is it Georgi Pick and Imre Lakatos? Yes. Can you talk about each in turn?
With pleasure, yes. Georg Pick was a Viennese mathematician. He was born, I think, 1860 or so. I don't have the date now at my fingertips. But he studied mathematics and then became professor of mathematics in Prague. For a short time, he was even a colleague of Albert Einstein because Albert Einstein's first professorship was in Prague. He stayed there only for a very short time. This was before the First World War. But Georg Pick was an eminent mathematician there. And after emeritating, he returned to Vienna. And this was a bad moment because this was in 1930.
Oh.
And anti-Semitism was rampant. And eventually in 38, the Nazis took over Austria. And Georg Pick had to return to Prague to flee. But a few years later, the Nazis captured Prague too. And he ended up in a concentration camp in Theresienstadt, where he was murdered. So it is a very, very sad story from beginnings in the golden age of Vienna, you know, late turn of the century, and then to this terrible manhunting of an old and dignified professor who could no longer understand the world around him.
How about Imre Lakatos?
Imre Lakatos was a Hungarian, born before the Second World War. I should say that in Hungary there is a wonderful tradition in mathematics. They have particularly many mathematicians, and from school on, I don't know how they do it, but they are very, very interested in it. And during the Second World War, Imre Lakatos joined an underground group to fight against the Nazis. And then when the Red Army took over, he joined the Communist Party and went to Moscow for his studies for a time. But he couldn't stand it in the long run, and he managed in the early 60s, I think, to emigrate or to flee to London. And in London, he became a colleague of Karl Popper and others in the London School of Economics. And he had, maybe from his work in the underground, in the political underground, he had some very subversive ideas about mathematics. At that time, the philosophy of mathematics was almost petrified by Carnap and others. It was dealing mostly with formalization of proofs and so on. And Lakatos said, hey, wait a minute, this is not at all what mathematicians are really doing. You should look at how they develop concepts, how they discuss, how they reject an idea and so on. And he wrote what could be Socratic dialogues, so to speak, about this exchange between a professor and his extremely gifted students, and showing how these notions of mathematics are alive and are molded by trial and error. And this was a wonderful experience for me, but I think also for many philosophers of mathematics.
It's what's fascinating about this book is you learn that the person is as fascinating as the mathematics and philosophy. That there, and you include a lot of that personal information in this book. And I found that really fascinating.
Yes. I think that here again, it is there is a parallel to music. Of course, music piece of music can stand all by itself. But it helps to learn who has composed it, what chagrin or what anxiousness or what happiness the composer had experienced and so on. It's the same thing with mathematics. So historical background gives a lot of color to it.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Carl Sigmund, Professor Emeritus of Mathematics at the University of Vienna. And we're talking about his book. It's a brilliant book. It's really wonderful to read. The Waltz of Reason, The Entanglement of Mathematics and Philosophy. Carl, I also learned that there was, and it's obvious, but I just one of those things that you have to read it to reinforce it in your mind. There's an evolution to understanding mathematical concepts. And I was surprised about this because I never thought about this before. But there were changing ideas about what infinity meant. And I find that for people who are just listening who are not mathematicians, they probably thought, well, okay, I think I have an understanding of infinity. But in fact, the history of the idea of infinity is wild.
Exactly. Well, first of all, in ancient Greece, mathematicians did everything they could to avoid the term infinity. It was taboo, yes? And in the Middle Ages, infinity, this was reserved for theologians. God was infinity.
Oh, right.
But nothing else could be, how dare you, or so, yes? And many great, eminent philosophers and mathematicians followed. Descartes or Gauss explicitly rejected the possibility of making sense with the concept of infinity. And then, in the second half of the 19th century, Georg Cantor suddenly said, why not? And he tried this hands-on approach and compared infinite sets, and said, can we say that one is as large as the other? Yes, we can, if we can associate to every member of one set a unique member of the other set, and vice versa. So he simply started working on that, and this within 10 years or so, this had a bandwagon effect, and all mathematicians were joining and using his concepts. For some time, there were some diehards who said, no, we shouldn't think about that. Essentially now, this concept of infinity is considered as completely natural.
Yeah. But it makes perfect sense
perfect sense.
But it also made perfect sense what you wrote about people in the medieval period going, it's verboten to be talking about it, because obviously that's the realm of the holy. That's the realm of God. So you shouldn't be following anything that you have to do with infinity. You're not God. Indeed. Don't do it. Mm-hmm. We're going to run out of time. There's a fascinating section for me in the book about computer-generated proofs for mathematics and what that leads to. And I've been familiar with some of the ones that have come up and that you talked about in your book. A lot of people may not realize this, but there are mathematical ideas, concepts, and theorems which can only be proved by computer. But that seems to me to lead to all sorts of problems. How can we know that that's a proof?
Well, this is a vast problem, and it has many different angles. I should say that in general, if you ask, ChatGPT or so, to prove a little exercise at school or so, it can do or it can fail. This is not so grandiose. But computers are extremely useful for verifying long proofs, shown that really you can formulate them step by step and that there is no hole in it. And so there they are very, very strong, these specialized theorem verifiers. And in particular, there are mathematical proofs which are, believe it or not, 2,000 pages long.
Hmm.
No human can master this. This is divided into sub-portion, and one solves this problem, and one studies this problem, and it is then brought together. But it helps, of course, enormously if you have, in the end, a computer who checks it all from the beginning to the end.
But yes. Wait a minute, Carl.
Yes.
Do those proofs then have to be rechecked by a human mind, or do you just accept the fact that the computer is infallible and therefore correct?
No. The computer is not infallible, of course, and there can also be programs which are wrong and which have glitches. There are also verifiers for programs. Actually, it's the same verifiers that can do the one thing and the other. And there are several different programs. Interestingly, these proof verifiers are developed in different nations. In France, they have a school, and in the United States, several, and so on. And these can cross-check each other. And so the probability of an error can never be really zero, but it is extremely, extremely small, much smaller than if a human was checking this. There are so many proofs that humans and even superb mathematicians have presented that turned out to be wrong.
Oh, I know that.
And this is human, after all. And the degree of certitude is now hugely enhanced by these theorem verifiers.
Just personally.
Now, this is some.
Kurt, do you feel a sense of loss that mathematics may be the realm of machine thinking in the future and not humans?
Not really, no. I
know that's a weird question. I'm sorry to just spring that on you. But I felt like a sense of loss. You know, I love the idea of mathematicians, and I've interviewed several, wrestling with problems and then eventually solving them. But now it seems like the important problems could all go to computer learning.
No, first of all, you have to define what is an important problem. And
to my knowledge,
this is still a human endeavor. And then a proof strategy, for instance, as far as I know, is always developed by humans first, except in very trivial cases. But whenever there is a real important mathematical problem, it is humans who find the proof strategy, where you go, in which direction. Then it could be that you end up with a case distinction where you have to study 100 different cases or so, and that this is too much for a single lifetime. And
this is
where the computer can come in handily.
So it's just a more sophisticated tool.
Like, I would say more than that, yes.
Okay.
More than that. I think it is also a great help socially, so to speak, in the Republic of Mathematicians, let's say, because when we prove a theorem, then in principle one or two persons should check it before it is accepted for publications. But there are so many erroneous proofs that are accepted.
Huh.
And say spawn more erroneous proofs and so on. And therefore it is very, very important that there is some standard that is where you can rely on. So ideally it would be the mathematicians who have the great ideas and the computers in the subground, in the cellar, that is verifying them.
What do you feel about AI? Do you think the dangers of AI are real, or just mostly we're fearing nothing?
I get sometimes quite depressed when I think of AI, but this may be just a consequence of my old age.
Yes,
but I have the feeling that the main danger for humanity is that we tend to lose contact with the real world and tend to live in a fake world, and be confused by the amount of information that can be faked easily and very convincingly. I mean, last week or so, that OpenAI presented a program for making short videos. You give in a prompt and you see a video of mammoths running through the ice or snowfields. And it is so absolutely convincing that whenever you open a TV show now, you cannot be sure, is this now, or a documentary, Is this real or is it not? So I feel that this is a grave danger. But as I said, this may be just old age pessimism.
Yeah, I don't think so. One of the things I love about your book is you did ask AI to write a poem. And that was crazy. It's like, we're almost out of time, so I'm not going to have you read it, but people need to buy the book. What kind of a poem did you ask AI to write?
Well, actually, I didn't do that, but the developers of GPT-4 wrote a paper on this. They challenged their program, and they challenged it with the question, can you write a proof that there are infinitely many primes with every line that rhymes? And so the computer answered. Do you want me to read it?
No, I think we're going to run out of time before you could get it done. Yes. You could read the first couple of lines, the first four lines.
Well, the answer was yes, I think I can. So it might take a clever plan. I'll start by noting Euclid's proof, which shows that primes aren't just aloof. These were the first four lines. Okay. And then it goes on, and yes, if it was a student saying this at an examination, I would ask a few questions afterwards to check. But I would let it pass as it is, yes?
We have only scratched the surface of this amazing book. My guest tonight has been Carl Zsigmond, Professor Emeritus of Mathematics at the University of Vienna. And his book we've been talking about is really interesting. Every chapter has got an amazing array of ideas. The Waltz of Reason, The Entanglement of Mathematics and Philosophy. Carl, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM.
Thank you.
This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.